The headlines this hour: Hamas says Israeli home demolitions will encourage Palestinians to fight to get back every inch of their land as the military blows up the house of a prisoner. And protesters in Sri Lanka defy a new state of emergency as anger builds over the government's mishandling of a worsening economic crisis. The United States has announced a new weapons package worth $150 million for Ukraine to use in its war with Russia. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Israeli forces have attacked a group of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. A young man has been injured and rushed to the hospital. The Palestinians were angry at the destruction of the home of a prisoner in Jenin. Omar Jaradat was detained in December of last year on charges of involvement in an operation that left an Israeli dead. Recently, an Israeli court ordered the demolition to go ahead. A senior member of Hamas resistance movement has condemned the move. Azat al-Rashq says Israel's insistence on continuing its crimes will not bring security to it or its settlers. He warned that the demolition of homes will only enhance the determination of Palestinians to resist the occupier and take back every inch of their land. Sri Lankan protesters are back on the streets of the capital, Colombo, in defiance of a state of emergency, calling on the government to step down. The protesters gathered outside of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's office and the residence of his brother, who is the prime minister. They blamed the government for a worsening economic crisis that has caused food, fuel, and medicine shortages. Similar protests took place outside of Parliament on Friday, when police used tear gas to disperse the crowd. Also on Friday, Sri Lankans staged a nationwide strike that brought the country to a standstill. Following that, the government announced the current state of emergency. That is the second in 5 weeks to quell anti-government protests. The state of emergency gives sweeping powers to security forces. The United States has announced a new weapons package worth $150 million for Ukraine to use in its war with Russia. President Joe Biden said the package will provide additional artillery munitions, radars, and other equipment. The U.S. had already sent more than $3.4 billion worth of weaponry to Ukraine. Biden has warned that current funding is running out, urging Congress to authorize more. He wants the chamber to authorize a huge $33 billion Ukraine package that includes $20 billion in military aid. The U.S. and its allies continue to supply arms to Ukraine, despite repeated warnings by Russia to stop that. Moscow has warned of unpredictable consequences if Ukraine gets more weapons. Journalist and political commentator Dmitry Zolotarev says the U.S. is helping its own manufacturers by supplying weapons to Ukraine.
Russia emphasized that it has to save as many civilian population of Ukraine as possible. And the slow moving of Russian army through Ukraine is explained only by that. Because if Russia followed the United States or Great Britain or NATO, should I say NATO rules, it would shell the whole territory of Ukraine, glass it flat, and the whole war would be over in a couple of days, like I said long before. So sending the weapons to Ukraine is only about making lots of profit to the United States and about the deterioration of economic situation inside the United States. And Biden administration is trying hard to create the situation of military contracts inside the United States to increase the military plans to supply more weapons.
The Italian government is reportedly considering introducing a new state of emergency linked to the conflict in Ukraine, a looming energy crisis, and the grave deterioration of the country's socio-economic situation are among the reasons. Max Cirilli has more from Rome.
It was March 31st when the Italian government put an end to a 2-year state of emergency due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Just over a month later, some Italian media are reporting that the Mario Draghi government is mulling over issuing a new state of emergency linked this time to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Some newspapers have even suggested that Draghi is considering postponing next year's general elections. The Ukraine war and the subsequent sanctions imposed on Moscow, in addition to Rome's decision to significantly cut off its supply of Russian gas, have had a ferocious impact on Italy's already struggling economy.
A government of common sense always works on dealing with more than just one scenario. Suggesting the adoption of war economy and new lockdowns is very much premature. I'd rather focus on diversifying Italy's energy supply sources and tackling unemployment, which is likely to soar significantly in autumn.
The National Association of Entrepreneurs Confindustria has recently said Italy's economy is heading for recession, which is defined by two consecutive quarters of GDP negative growth. Last month, the Italian government revised down its 2022 economic growth forecast to 3.1% from a 4.7% projection made last September, a forecast considered optimistic by most independent bodies. Economists have warned that surging food and energy prices will seriously affect Italians' spending power, leading to an excruciating decline in domestic demand. It is also estimated that 500,000 workers are expected to lose their job should Italy completely halt its gas supplies from Russia.
Giving up the Russian supplies will be a catastrophe for the European manufacturer, and for Italy this would be managed only through a profound alteration of the democratic rules.
Last year, Italy had recorded a strong recovery from its economic contraction of nearly 9% in 2020 due to the restrictions adopted to counter the COVID crisis. That recovery has been cancelled by the measures undertaken to sanction Russia over the conflict in Ukraine. Max Civili, Rome.
What a panic has engulfed Rohingya refugee camps across India, as the South Asian nation intends to deport thousands of Rohingya refugees amid calls for a concrete refugee policy. As Munawar Zaman reports from India, many are living in hidings in many parts of the country, fearing detention and separation from families.
It was challenging to convince these refugees at this camp in northern India to allow entry with a camera. Everyone was alarmed and started hiding their faces, while others emptied their shanties and some turned their backs. Rohingya refugees in India are in a desperate situation following renewed detention and deportation campaigns from the administration. Schools have already been detained while some deported. Intense crackdown on the community has created fear, which has led to sleepless nights amid worries of night raids and family separations. This old man, a little familiar with the local language, says, "I don't go out of the camp and prefer dying here than in a detention camp." Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are living in an appalling situation with little or no help from anyone. Even the UN Refugee Agency is watching as a silent spectator, they said. Their men were involved in menial work for survival. However, due to detention fear, they had no choice but to abandon work and stick together in their camps.
Finding this camp wasn't easy, and upon reaching here, panic and horror was visible on every face. They got terrified upon seeing us and rushed to hidings, saying media in India is portraying their image very negatively, and this has made their survival even harder.
According to rights activists, refugee crises across the world are alarming, but this particular community continues to be an unseen victim of immeasurable extents of violence. Based on official estimates, more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India after fleeing a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, a vicious hate campaign and their expulsion is haunting the community.
We appeal to the UN. We have no support. We need your help and the help from the Indian government to stay alive. We are in acute pain and distress. We reached here just with our lives intact. Please do not detain us, deport us, or separate us from families. Rather, kill us. We have no strength to face more.
Activists say the need of the hour is to protect the rights of these refugees and secure their survival rather than deliberately targeting them and deporting them, despite the fact their lives are under threat back in Myanmar. Rights activists have urged the Indian government to formulate a uniform refugee policy since the country has no refugee law. They urge the Indian government to treat refugees equally, regardless of caste, ethnicity or faith. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. In the Northern Ireland Assembly election, Nationalist Party Sinn Féin is on course for a historic first-ever win, posing a serious threat to the Union of the United Kingdom. The Republican Party has so far secured 18 seats of the 90-seat legislature and only needs 10 more to claim the role of First Minister for leader Michelle O'Neill. The pro-UK Democratic Unionist Party is in second place. It occupied the role of the First Minister in the outgoing Stormont Assembly. A Unionist Party has been the largest in government since Northern Ireland was formed in 1921. The ultimate goal of Sinn Féin is for Northern Ireland to leave the UK and become one country with the Republic of Ireland. Meanwhile, in the UK's local elections, embattled Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party has lost control of key councils, including in London. The Tories suffered an overall loss of almost 400 councillors in the vote. Pro-independence sentiments also remain strong in Scotland, where the Scottish National Party again finished as the biggest winner in the council elections. Saeed Poor is our correspondent, joining us from London for the latest on this. We also have Andre Murphy, an Irish journalist and political commentator, joining us from Belfast. Welcome to you both. Saeed, over to you. You have lots to give to us in the form of a roundup, if you can, of the different wins and losses, of course.
Yes, Governor. Here in the in England, as you heard the Prime Minister Boris Johnson say, it was a tough night for him in the evening of the Thursday's elections, but not catastrophic. But we did see the Conservatives lose a lot of seats, especially in some of their strongholds, such as Wandsworth, as well as Westminster and Barnet. These are districts inside London and also beyond. That was huge for them. On the other hand, big gains for the Labour Party. The people I talked to hoping that Labour will be able to emerge as the largest party in 2024, when the next general election will be held here in England. The reason, there are multiple reasons, starting from Partygate to the rising cost of living, as well as the sanctions they imposed on Russia with the military conflict in Ukraine, that have come to hurt vulnerable Britons here in the UK, and a number of other reasons. Over in Northern Ireland, as you said, Sinn Féin, the first time poised to win this election and be in the seat of First Minister, pushing the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, these are people who want to be part of the United Kingdom, into second place. That raises serious questions about the future of the union, as you said, as well as whether or not the DUP will agree to play second fiddle to Sinn Féin. There are others who are pushing, really, or taking it another step further and saying there is a possibility that this will bring back what the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 put an end to the 30 years of the troubles or conflict between the Protestants and Catholics, the Republicans and the Unionists.
Thank you so much for that. Let's move on to Andre Murphy. Andre Murphy, at this point, we're looking at, obviously, Sinn Féin. I'm sure they're ecstatic about this, as the video proves that point. Ultimately, though, tell us what their ultimate goal is here, or one of them, and from what we understand, is to unite with the Republic of Ireland, if I'm correct in saying that, if you can give us your views on this.
You know, I think it's really important to put it in the historical context that we're 101 years since the partition of our country, the designing of the Northern state, which was to be a unionist state for a unionist people with an artificial majority built in. It was maintained with discrimination against the Catholic and Irish population, and often with violence and repressive laws. And now, 100 years later, we have Republicans who were not welcome when they were born into this state, now holding the majority of power. It is absolutely seismic what has happened. The vote itself took place on the anniversary of the death of hunger striker Bobby Sands in 1981. There is so much historical resonance as to the significance of this, of what's happened. For Sinn Féin, they are dealing with the Good Friday Agreement being under consistent attack, not only by unionism, who is really unsure as to how they deal with the emerging nationalist majority. They are unsure, and the British government, who really reneges on international agreements all the time, whether it's the Good Friday Agreement or whether it's the Brexit Agreement and the special measures that have been put in place in the north. You know, so Sinn Féin wants to do power sharing, wants to do it with those who are unionist and those who don't designate as either unionist or nationalist. And now they'll be at the centre of making the decisions around that with the first ministry position. In parallel with that, there is a growing expectation that there will be a vote within the next 5 to 10 years on Irish unity. It's overwhelmingly supported in the south, and there is a lot of signs that there is a growing population leading to a majority, certainly half and half, that would like Irish unity north of the border as well. And for Sinn Féin, obviously an Irish Republican Party that wants to see unity in the country, it is very much a supporting the Good Friday Agreement mechanisms, ensuring that there is effective power sharing, but also contributing to the planning for what a united Ireland will look like in 5 to 10 years' time, to ensure that another chaotic Brexit doesn't happen, that it doesn't just happen kind of without the planning that's necessary for a new country.
Thank you so much for that, Andrea Murphy, Irish journalist and political commentator from Belfast, Saeed Purizza. Thank you so much for giving us an update on all of that. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In a rare convergence, America's voters are not merely unhappy with their political leadership, but awash in fears about economic security, border security, international security, and even physical security. The article you're about to hear has been written by Mark Penn, a pollster and former advisor to President Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton from 1995 to 2008. Mark Penn is the chairman of Harris Poll and CEO of Stagwell Inc. The article has been published by the New York Times. It is titled, American voters haven't been afraid like this in a long time. In a rare convergence, America's voters are not merely unhappy with their political leadership, but awash in fears about economic security, border security, international security, and even physical security. Without a U-turn by the Biden administration, these fears will generate a wave election like those in 1994 and 2010, setting off a chain reaction that could flip the House and the Senate to Republican control in November, and ultimately the presidency in 2024. Take the economy, so often the harbinger of election results. From late 2017 until the pandemic, a majority of Americans believed that the economy was strong, and from 2014 until the pandemic, at least a plurality believed their personal economic situation was improving. COVID-19 cut sharply into that feeling of well-being. This was initially seen as temporary, though, and trillions of dollars flowed into keeping people afloat. But then, near double-digit inflation hit consumers for the first time in 40 years. 60% of American voters now see the economy as weak, and 48% say their financial situation is worsening, according to a Harris poll conducted on 20th and 21st of April. Many Americans under the age of 60 have relatively little experience with anything but comparatively low fuel costs, negligible interest rates, and stable prices. Virtually overnight, these assumptions have been shaken. Only 35% approve of President Joe Biden's handling of inflation. These economic blows are just one element in a cascading set of problems, all hitting at the same time. It combines the nuclear anxieties of the 1950s and 1960s with the inflation threat of the 70s, the crime wave of the 1980s and 90s, and the tensions over illegal immigration in the 2000s and beyond. This electorate is not experiencing a malaise, as President Jimmy Carter was once apocryphally said to have proclaimed, but has instead formed into a deep national fissure ready to blow like a geyser in the next election if leadership does not move to relieve the pressure. The return of fear about crime is especially worrisome for Democrats, who spent years trying to take over Republican ground on the issue. In 1991, the homicide rate was 9.71 per 100,000 of the population. Joe Biden, when he was a senator, wrote the key federal bipartisan anti-crime bill, widely credited then with reducing violence in America, but under criticism today by those who argue it led to inequitable rates of incarceration, particularly in communities of color. The homicide rate would decline to a low of 4.44 per 100,000 of the population in 2014. Worries about walking the streets and riding the subway were less acute among new generations. And yet today, those same streets and mass transit are once again hobbled by fear. Even the head of the New York Area Metropolitan Transportation Authority argued that fear of crime and homelessness was behind a 36% drop in ridership between December of 2021 and January of 2022. Immigration was used effectively by President Donald Trump as a wedge issue to win working-class voters. According to the April Harris poll, under Joe Biden, 59% of voters believe that we have effectively opened borders, and looking back, many even support some of Donald Trump's immigration policies. Joe Biden receives only 38% approval for his immigration policy, a troublingly low rating for a Democrat. President Barack Obama was at 29% approval on immigration policy before the 2000-term midterm wipeout. National security had become less salient for most Americans compared to the years of the Cold War and after 9/11. Foreign policy was barely discussed in the limited presidential debates of 2020. Today, fear of a great power conflict and nuclear weapons has emerged in ways not seen since the Cold War. With a conflict in Ukraine and fresh ballistic missile tests, fear of nuclear weapons has been thrust at front and center, as a recent focus group of Americans by New York Times Opinion found out as well. Fear of nuclear weapons now ranks second in issues that worry voters behind the effects of inflation. Combat the drag that fear has on the electorate, what I call a fear index, Joe Biden will have to move in some big and bold ways. Faced with runaway spending in the 1990s, President Bill Clinton proposed a balanced budget, a policy still favored by 80% of the electorate, according to April's Harris poll. But he did it in a way that still managed to finance entitlements like Social Security. Pushing a big 7-year policy plan like that would mean finding budget cuts elsewhere to pay for a permanent child tax credit, rather than raising taxes and deficit spending, which would most likely cause costs to fall on the average American through inflation. Balancing the budget would change the conversation about the economy and show Americans that Joe Biden was serious about getting our fiscal house in order. Continuing to let gas prices surge will hurt Democrats on the ballot in the fall. The party needs a new tempered energy policy that includes a more gradual transition to alternative fuels and an appreciation of energy independence. In the presidential debates, Joe Biden promised a transition to renewable energy over time, though noting he would not attempt to ban fracking. But in his first flurry of executive orders, Mr. Biden gave the public the impression he was far more aggressive in favoring climate change policies, though he has since angered activists by reversing a promise to prevent new drilling on public lands. He will need to shift to an all-of-the-above energy approach and greenlight the Keystone pipeline, which 65% of the electorate says should move forward, according to the Harris poll. The Biden administration is also losing in swing areas on immigration, as evidenced by the 9 Senate Democrats and the House's bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus that have expressed reservations about its plan to lift Title 42. The Trump administration's COVID-era policy of intercepting and returning migrants without due process. The answer is to keep in place the COVID-related border restrictions and revive trying to find a real compromise with at least 10 Republican senators on immigration that would adopt tougher barrier and enforcement measures to close the border, but also open up legal immigration and a path to citizenship for at least DACA recipients. With rising crime as an issue, the favorable rating of the Department of Justice has sunk to just 51% under Merrick Garland, according to the Harris poll. Joe Biden needs to shake up his top law enforcement officials and back legislation that combines police reform with funding for hundreds of thousands of new community police officers, greater federal involvement in stopping violent crime syndicates and gangs, and wider discretion for judges to take violent criminals off the streets. The Biden administration needs to consider interceding on behalf of victims in circumstances in which district attorneys are not prosecuting violent criminals to the full extent of the law, especially when they waive enhancements for gang-related crimes. One of the first campaign advertisements in 1996 established President Clinton as both against assault weapons and for more cops and crime-fighting measures. He kept that message up during his re-election bid, and Republicans never effectively stoked fears about crime. Finally, the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan precipitated a decline in Biden administration's approval rates. According to reports, Joe Biden now says he's running for re-election in 2024, but he's facing limited enthusiasm in his own party for a second run and loses even to Donald Trump in hypothetical matchups, according to the Harris poll. Sticking to the high-priced Build Back Better legislation or variants of it on the basis of narrow party line votes has not been successful. People are afraid of being walloped financially, being injured or menaced by criminals, being in a country without strong borders or COVID protections for immigrants, and being under threat of nuclear weapons. If Joe Biden and Democratic leaders cannot effectively address these fears, the wave election will hit them this November, and the president will then face a sobering choice of either passing the baton to another candidate in 2024 or finding the bold leadership necessary to reconcile his drive for more progressive policies with the realities of economics, politics, and a more dangerous world.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. We're discussing the Akhirah, which is a very, very important discussion in Quran and Sunnah. And the idea is for you and I to get these reminders and to use these kind of things that we find in Quran and Sunnah to help us to become those best believers. Inshallah, the elite soldiers of the Imam of the time. So when we began our journey into Barzakh, we started with the Qabr and those things that happen in the Qabr. As the Prophet told us in that one hadith, إِنَّ الْقَابْرِ أَوَّلُ مَنَازِلَ الْآخِرَةِ. The grave is the first of the stages of the hereafter. Now, one thing that I should mention, brothers and sisters, is that it is frightening, meaning transitioning from this world to the next, even for the believers, we're told is frightening. Even though, inshallah, we will be amongst those who get to see the Ahlul Bayt before we depart this world. That in itself is a great blessing. The believer dies easy, but does it mean that afterwards the grave is not frightening, even for the believer, that there's not concern, or rather that we should be like Imam Sajjad? Remember that one dua that we were reading where the Imam is crying about his soul leaving his body. So it is frightening. And we're told, this is now in a hadith from Imam Ridha, he says, فَإِنَّ لِلْقَبْرِ أَحْوَالًا عَظِيمًا. There are some terrifying things that happen in that next world. This is let alone the sirat and all of those other things. Just the grave itself is terrifying. In some of our ahadith, it's mentioned that the combination of these things make it so difficult for the person who's leaving this world that the Prophet has said this, لَيْسَ أَشَدُّ عَلَى الْمَيِّتِ مِنَ اللَّيْلَةِ الْأُولَى. There is nothing more terrifying and more scary for the mayyit than that first night. Because after a while, things will get easier for the believer. For the believer, things will get easier. Inshallah, wait till you hear the end, inshallah, where the angels are giving us good tidings. Inshallah, we're one of those people. The angels are giving us good tidings. The door to heaven is open. It gets easier. The life in the barzakh, we need to talk about that. But initially, that first stage, the shock, the trauma of going through that is something that is terrifying. We learn from some of the ahadith that even after the ordeal is over, so let's say I passed that first stage and now, alhamdulillah, that still the mayit is tired. The other amwat, the others who are there, they give that person, the new person who just came, some time because it's just so traumatic going through all of that stage. So our first discussion is, what can we do to make things a little easy for ourselves? Meaning, now for others. We're hopeful that if we do these things, inshallah, some will do them also for us. Because there's things that we're told in the ahadith that would make life a little easier for the mayyit. Now they're struggling. They need every bit of help that they can get. There's some things that might seem small to you and I, but for that mayyit, remember there's a hadith that I've shared with you before, where the things that you do, they're better for the mayyit than a dunya wa ma fiha. The mayyit needs every little bit of help that they could get. So we'll start off in that way with what are a few things that we can do for this person who's making this transition The Prophet actually, in this hadith, he tells us to have mercy on the mayyit. He says, farhamu mawtakum. Have mercy on your dead. Bitilka layla. On that first night, that first difficult night, one of the things that was a little new for me was the idea of giving sadaqah. Number one. What is something we can do? One of the things that's mentioned is actually giving sadaqah for the mayyit. Warding off bala for that mayyit. But you and I, we're here, we can give some sadaqah. In addition to that, there's that very famous 2 rakat prayer. I'm sure you and I, we've seen it. Some of us, when our relatives have passed, will be the people who are, please, if you can, just recite a 2 rakat prayer. In some of the ahadith, there's another 2 rakat prayer that you can also give as a gift. But there's a famous one that you recite for the person. That one, ideally after Isha, the first night of the person when they're in the grave. Ideally after Isha, but they say any time during that night, you can recite it for that person. And the effects of that are tremendous. So that prayer, brothers and sisters, is something we can do for one another, and it makes life easy for the mayit, in addition to, of course, the sadaqah. Another one that's good for us to do, brothers and sisters, is for 40 of us to gather. Inshallah, there's 40 of us. We can get 40 believers to go over and testify and say that we don't know anything but good from this person. Allah also is mentioned in the hadith that if you testify, then a lot of his kindness, he will say, you say, I know things that you don't know. You're saying that we don't know anything but khair from this person because that's what we're taught to say. It doesn't mean that the person is sinless or hasn't made any mistakes. People can have made mistakes. But we know that they're Muslim. They weren't an enemy of Allah. We don't know anything but good from this person. You do that, God, out of his kindness, he'll accept. And the mayyit obviously can use that. So that's another one of those things that we can definitely do. Another one that we're told to do is to not just leave immediately. Not to leave and abandon the mayyit immediately. And just to go back to not have anything to do with the mayyit. Rather, if we can spend some time reciting Quran for that person, making dua for that person. Like we see with Lady Fatima when she passed, then she asked Amir al-Mu'mineen to stay behind and to recite Quran for her. It makes a difference. The person who's dying, the person who's dead, at that stage, having a person, a living person who's still reciting some Quran for me, checking on me, not leaving me, and not abandoning me is huge. It makes a tremendous difference to the mayyit. So those are just some of the things that we can do. Oh, another one that's there that's mentioned also as another stage is for those who are closest to the mayyit, the relatives. You and I were friends of the believers. Let's say this happens to one of us. God knows which of us goes first. They say that the relatives, to stay there and then to do talqeen of the mayyit from on top of the grave in a loud voice. By the way, there was one thing that I forgot. Now, alhamdulillah, came to my mind. And that is that you've seen in the risala that it says that there's certain adab that we should observe when a person dies. One of them is that we don't just dump the mayyit and run. We bring the person close to their grave. We put them down. We bring them closer, we put them down. We do this 3 times, and the 4th time we actually put them into the grave. But then now when everybody's departed, some of those family members are staying behind. Those people who are staying behind, now the idea is, can I do that talqeen for the mayyit? And if we do that talqeen for the mayyit, it's mentioned in a hadith that Nakir and Munkar will say that, let's leave. And I'm going to get into the actual interrogation, how terrible that is. So that in itself, the idea that if this brings some relief for the amwat, this is, again, this is something which is tremendous and something definitely that we want to do.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adim Alimun Halim.
قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime perpetrates the crime of apartheid against Palestinians. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading UN Expert Says Zionist Regime Practices Apartheid Against Palestinians. Here's more. The Zionist regime perpetrates the crime of apartheid against Palestinians, and third states should support accountability efforts at international courts. So states Michael Link, an independent United Nations human rights expert from Canada, in a new report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva recently. Last year, that body voted in favor of establishing a permanent commission of inquiry into the Zionist regime's violations of Palestinian rights in all the territory under its control, including inside the 1949 armistice line, demarcating the Zionist regime from the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime is nervous that the commission, led by three experts, whose report is expected to be published in June, will characterize it as an apartheid regime, according to a foreign ministry cable seen by the news publication Axios. Link's new periodic report, as a special rapporteur to the UN Human Rights Council, follows a handful of studies from high-profile Israeli and international human rights organizations concluding that the Zionist regime practices apartheid against Palestinians, mainstreaming and aspects of what their Palestinian counterparts have been saying about the Zionist regime rule for decades. Acknowledging the seeming performance of the Zionist regime's military occupation, human rights groups are also calling for an approach centered on rights and accountability rather than moribund peace process towards a two-state solution championed by the United Nations and other entities complicit in the prolonged situation of injustice in Palestine. The Zionist regime has refused to cooperate with the Human Rights Council Commission of Inquiry and has denied entry and boycotted Link and experts who have previously held the role of a special rapporteur for human rights in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Link notes that, consistent with the mandate of the special rapporteur, his periodic report focuses on Israeli practices in the West Bank, including East al-Quds and Gaza. As such, he does not examine policy towards Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories or Palestinian refugees in exile, but acknowledges that Palestinian, Israeli, and international groups have concluded that it is impossible to have democracy here and apartheid there.
Link observes that by their very nature, occupations are required to be built with wood, not concrete. With the establishment of 300 Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank since 1967, and a massive wall built mostly on Palestinian land in the same territory, the Zionist regime occupation has involved a great amount of concrete. Meanwhile, in Gaza, for the past 15 years, Palestinians there have been barricaded into an open-air prison, Link states, adding a method of population control unique in the modern world. People in Gaza have endured four highly asymmetrical wars with the Zionist regime during that time, with enormous loss of human life and immense property destruction. The Zionist regime leaders have regularly and openly proclaimed that the regime's rule over the Palestinians and their land is permanent and that no Palestinian state will emerge, Link adds. The intent is for the Palestinians to be encased in a political ossuary, a museum relic of 21st century colonialism. The human rights expert observes that an institutionalized regime of systematic racial oppression is at the heart of the Zionist regime's settler colonial project in Palestine. For example, Israelis residing in Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank enjoy comprehensive rights, while Palestinians in the same territory live under military rule and control. The Zionist regime settlement enterprise is meanwhile meant to demographically engineer an unlawful sovereignty claim through the annexation of territory. And because it is impossible for a colonial power to expropriate land and resources for its own population without also immiserating the indigenous people and triggering their perpetual rebellion, the Zionist regime has imposed increasingly harsh methods of control over Palestinians. The Zionist regime's practices against Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza therefore pass the test of applicability of an international legal definition of apartheid, Link states. He observes that only the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, adopted by the UN General Assembly in 1973, the Rome Statute providing the foundation of the International Criminal Court, drafted 25 years later, provide legal definitions for apartheid. A contemporary legal definition of apartheid drawn from and consistent with both the Convention and the Rome Statute would stipulate there exists an institutionalized regime of systematic racial oppression and discrimination, established with the intent to maintain the domination of one racial group over another, and which features inhumane acts committed as an integral part of the regime. All three features must be fulfilled for a situation to be considered one of apartheid, Link adds. Examples or patterns of racial discrimination by themselves are insufficient. The social construction of racial identity should be seen as a matter of perception, particularly in the eyes of a dominant group that distinguishes itself from other groups based on social markers such as nationality, ethnicity, religion, ancestry, and descent, Link says. In the case of the Zionist regime and the Palestinians, the former has determined the allocation and the denial of the rights in the occupied Palestinian territory through a series of laws, practices, and policies which define who is a Jew and who is not a Jew, according to Link. Under this system, the freedoms of one group are inextricably bound up in the subjugation of another. Palestinian human rights group welcomed Link's seminal report, the first by UN Special Rapporteur to definitely state that the Zionist regime practices apartheid. Unsurprisingly, the Zionist regime officials rejected Link's findings. Mariavi Lyon-Sahar, the Zionist regime permanent representative to the United Nations in Geneva, accused the independent expert of recycling baseless and outrageous libels. She added that Link aims to delegitimize and criminalize the regime of Israel for what it is, the state of Jewish people with equal rights for all citizens, she baselessly claimed. As Link notes in his report, however, the 5 million Palestinians under the Zionist regime military occupation are stateless and living without rights, in an acute state of subjugation and with no path to self-determination. And as for the more than 1.5 million Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, the lie of democracy is dispelled by Benjamin Netanyahu, whose office as prime minister ended last year after more than a decade, saying Israel is not a state of all citizens, but the state of Jewish people and them alone.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Another achievement of ours, which is an indicator in itself and which must receive due attention, is our scientific, industrial, and technological progress. At a time when we were under international pressures of all sorts, we managed to progress in various scientific and industrial areas. This is not a minor achievement, rather it is very important. A number of popular associations, popular investment associations, have accomplished outstanding things. A few weeks ago, there was a meeting at this Husseiniyah, which was broadcast on television. You might have seen it. Entrepreneurs came and delivered reports. They were not only some verbal reports, rather the images were completely shown. It showed what great things they accomplished. Active companies in the area of production and other areas carried out certain tasks. Another criterion that we can rely on is that the people-run managerial orientation of the country moved smoothly.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Just take a look at some countries which have numerous problems in their managerial issues and in their elections, early elections, annulment of elections, and the like. However, in a country, despite all enemies, the affairs moved forward in a legal and correct way, and it produced good results. These are important criteria for the affairs of the country. If you compare these with other countries, then it becomes clear how important these are. I wish to clearly state that these achievements and the many others that exist, such as the strategic depth and spiritual influence in other countries, have turned the Islamic Republic into an attractive model. The Islamic Republic is certainly an attractive model for many nations today. Of course, we have not done enough promotions. Others propagandize against us to a great extent. The propaganda against the Islamic Republic is several times more than our own promotions. Therefore, many nations and countries are not aware of this. Thankfully, the Islamic Republic is an attractive model for those who are in contact with us and who are well informed.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.